The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis. Welcome to the social studio.
Thank you for downloading the weekly podcast from radiotoday.co.uk. Now, it won't have escaped your attention, whether you listen to music radio or speech radio, whether you listen to the BBC or commercial radio or even community radio, that there's been a general election. Some people said the campaign was a bit boring. Nobody said the result was a bit boring. And I thought we ought to talk about how radio coped and how it's going to cope in the future with the new Conservative government and what rules are going to change about how we cover politics. And to talk about that, I've come to Selwyn College in Cambridge to talk to the master, who is Roger Mosey, better known these days as a commentator on broadcasting affairs, but previously controller of BBC Five Live and head of BBC Television News. So you've covered a few elections in your time. How do you think radio did on this occasion, Roger?
In the big picture, I think that there was a huge amount of energy. I think people worked very hard. I salute all the innovation that went into the campaign and the way it was brought to people. And, you know, I couldn't possibly fault the way that people gave their all to the campaign. I think the big structural problem in it was that a lot of campaign coverage was based on something that turned out not to be true. And there was an over-reliance on polls and an over-reliance on hypotheticals, which meant, I think, that if you look back as a historian and think about that campaign in 2015, you will be very puzzled by the amount of time spent talking about red lines and hung parliaments when you ended up with majority government. And I think that was a little bit foreseeable. You should always be very, very careful before you go too far into hypotheticals.
Is that because people doing particularly radio news bulletins in music networks think they've got to keep everything brief, and a poll is a piece of news that's very easy to talk about, perhaps easier than what are the parties saying about foreign affairs or renationalisation?
I think that may be right. And you missed out the bit that I was on the Today programme and World at One and Radio 4 programmes. And I was there during the John Burt era. And John Burt has his critics. But John Burt had two things that he always thought were incredibly important. The first was, don't get over-obsessed about polls. John was the person who stopped us leading on polls, talking about polls too much. Because he rightly, I think, thought they were a sterile thing to talk about. They're about process. And what people care about, I think, is much more policy. They care about their education, their health service. They care about the way the country's going to develop in foreign policy or whatever. And they don't actually bother as much about the horse race as journalists do. The second thing that John did was sometimes we would have for an election, and I'd find this quite onerous, we'd have a grid, and the grid would say, you have to do something about agriculture, you have to do something about home affairs, you have to do something about education. And I would bridle sometimes and think, why do we have to do agriculture on the World at One? But it's because there are some important subjects which you need to force onto an election agenda. And one example from this week is suddenly everybody this week on Monday was talking about the abolition of the Human Rights Act. Now, how much time they've spent talking about the Human Rights Act and does it make any sense for justice and individual liberty in this country versus the amount of time spent on, you know, will Labour get into bed with the SNP and if they do, what might Nicola Sturgeon want? You can see that there is a case for having a slightly more systematic approach to the way you cover these big events.
It's interesting that you were talking about John Burt saying you must bring these items onto the agenda. I wonder whether, since John Burt's day, the BBC and elsewhere, we let the parties make the running. You know, the headline story in the morning is often the leader of this party will be announcing that, or the leader of another party will be saying this. Do you think we wait as journalists for them to tell us what the news is?
I think there is a bit too much of that. I think there are two things. One is the parties setting the agenda by their press conference on something. Of course, what the parties did to make life more difficult this time was they abolished their daily press conferences. So whereas in the past you might have had a story running between three press conferences in the morning, the party stopped that precisely because they didn't want stories outside their control to be the dominant thing. The other, I think, sometimes is you can have two bits of slightly lazy journalism. One is to say the party leaders have been on the campaign trail today. You know, what a surprise it would be if they weren't. And the other one is that day after day, the top story allegedly may be David Cameron says they've got a long-term economic plan, Ed Miliband says they're the party for working families, and Nick Clegg says they will ameliorate the terrible things of the other two parties. And that's what they say every single day. Now, you have a choice then of, do you do that story every single day, or do you say, you know what, today we're going to look at Europe and the referendum, and that's going to be what this programme does or this bulletin does, because we think it's important. And you have to have that balance between what the politicians want to talk about and the issues that you as a journalist believe are significant for people.
How do you think we as journalists dealt with the arrival of the multi-party system? You know, that I've read some people saying that there was perhaps a bit too much UKIP and a bit too little Lib Dem, and certainly too much SNP within England. I mean, how as a whole did we do, do you think?
It's, again, a slightly contradictory picture, I think. On the one hand, in the past, and when I was there, there was too much just of the three parties. I think we weren't good enough at reflecting the way that Britain is changing in politics. This time around, there was a much better attempt to cover that, and I applaud that. But I think there were some problems introduced by, first of all, once you decide that UKIP is a major party, it then made it very, very hard not to include the Greens and then the SNP and Plaid Cymru in the national debates. And I think that ended up being disproportionate. And I'm not being unfair to Plaid Cymru here, I hope. But Plaid Cymru went into the election with three MPs and a grand total of 165,000 votes in the previous election. And yet they got two national televised debates on absolutely equal status in those debates with Ed Miliband, who had over 200 seats and many, many millions more votes. And that ended up being a bit disproportionate. So it's a terribly difficult balancing act, because you don't want to exclude minority opinion. I would say probably the smaller parties got too much of the big high-profile set pieces. And there are, of course, ways, as you know, of not ignoring them, but making sure that they are in bulletins or in programming separate interviews without being in every single major set piece.
Because we seem to manage with the Irish parties, didn't we? Because we just said, well, we're not talking about them at all.
Yeah, and that, I think, was some injustice to Ireland. Now, I did appear on Stephen Nolan's excellent programme on Five Live, and I was upbraided by Stephen Nolan for arguing that Northern Irish parties shouldn't be in the debates. And I did that on entirely practical grounds, which is, I think you can argue there is a separate politics in Northern Ireland because all the parties are different to the mainland parties. But the biggest thing is the simple impracticality of putting 12 parties into a debate with Cameron and Miliband and Clegg and everybody else. I just don't think you could have made that work. But there was relatively a bit of an injustice to Northern Ireland in its profile during the campaign, as against the profile of Wales and certainly Scotland.
Now, what do you make of what I would characterise as an obsession in general election coverage with, we've come here to a marginal constituency, we've packed our suitcases, we've left London and we've come to God knows where to talk to some real people? Do you think that kind of journalism is at all helpful?
Again, mixed feelings. I think some of the vox pops and some of the audience interaction on bulletins was bland and meaningless. And I think you need to make a judgment when you go out there. And I saw too many pieces which was, here's a pretty seaside town and here's a nice person and she says this and he says that and who knows and time will tell.
And they don't tell us how many people they had to ask before they got that sample.
It's just not very illuminating. And I think when you heard it done at length and more properly, and again, I'm not being too loyal to my old alma mater, I suppose, but I thought that some of today's pieces did get a bit more depth. I thought some of Five Live's constituency reports, I thought the first one they did from Grimsby was really good and gave you a flavour of a local campaign. And I also felt that what I heard, I didn't hear a huge amount, but what I heard of BBC Local Radio sometimes doing hustings programmes, I thought they got some of the passion of the campaign and the interaction in a way that the national broadcasters struggled with. And you're certainly right, there is always a risk that national broadcasters sound like intrepid explorers suddenly finding that there are donkeys at Great Yarmouth, or my goodness, there's a curling rink in Paisley. And it can sound a bit patronising if you live in Paisley or Great Yarmouth.
One of the things that you touched on in your blog in the New Statesman is this business of how we, if we work on a local station or regionally, need to be careful about having our agenda set by whichever party has sent their party leader or their bigwig to see us. Sometimes we're on BBC Radio Nowhere or 107, The Beaver, and we're kind of dazzled, aren't we, by these big names have turned up from Westminster, and we're perhaps not as rigorous as we should be.
I think it's pretty good, and I worked on Radio Northampton in the 1983 campaign, Lost in the Mystery of Time, and we had Norman Tebbit and Mrs. Thatcher came to the area, and we had the Labour leadership there as well, Roy Hattersley, and it is good, and I think it's absolutely what local radio is there for, and I don't think local radio gives politicians a soft ride. What I was picking up was that I think the Conservatives as a strategy went much harder on you can have the Prime Minister for your morning show or for your breakfast show, which is something that Mrs. Thatcher would not entirely have appeared on Melvin in the Morning on Radio Lincolnshire, but David Cameron did, and I think that's good. And I heard one interview, I listened back when I was researching the New Statesman pieces, I heard an interview that they did on Radio Merseyside with Cameron, which is extremely combative and, you know, quite properly too. So I don't think they're soft. I do think there is clearly an agenda which the Tory party at the moment is getting very good at, of offering people in a way that makes you feel jolly pleased and excited about it, and it gives you, you know, great content. But you have to be careful that there is the balance across the whole of the campaign, and that the interviews are properly conducted. But I think for the most part, I don't think it's a major problem. I think it's an interesting opportunity which has some challenges that we should keep talking about.
You mentioned combative interviews. John Humphreys was at his most combative, I thought, with his interviews with the party leaders on the Today programme. And there was one of them, I have to admit, I had to switch off because I'd had enough of John and I wanted the other person to be talking.
Well, I adore John, and John is a close friend as well as a former colleague. I think what I would pick up is you always have to think about what the answer to a question is, as well as a good question.
But if I keep interrupting you, what use is that? Shouldn't I be letting you finish your sentence?
I don't like... Very good, Trevor. I don't like interrupting on a first answer, and I saw some of that more on TV, actually, where somebody comes in with an answer which you know is a pre-prepared answer, you know what you're going to get. But because the interviewer knows you're going to get that, they chop in after 5 seconds. And I think you have to give people the chance to answer a first question properly, and also editorially through the interview, the chance to answer subsequent substantive questions. But if they just give you the same answer over and over again, I don't mind a bit of interruption, that's fine. But this test of, are they going to give me an interesting answer? So the one that throughout the campaign, was Ed Miliband going to say, well, here are the things that I might work with Nicola Sturgeon on if I had to, and these are the compromises I might have to make on some primary legislation? Well, no, he wasn't. He was always going to say, I'm going for a majority government, and that was what David Cameron said every time. And interviews about the red lines of the Conservative and Labour Party never got anywhere. And you'll see, I wrote in New Statesman probably about week two, these are never going to go anywhere, and they didn't. You never got a breakthrough on that line of questioning, because you were never going to do. And that's the point where, sure, you have a journalistic obligation to put the question sometimes, but you really cannot just ask the same question 15 times if it's pointless, and it's boring for the audience if you're just going to get boring answers.
So we've read since the election that the BBC was rabidly anti-conservative. We've read, on the contrary, it was rabidly anti-Labour. This is pretty much par for the course, isn't it? How did you feel the BBC did in terms of overall balance?
I think it's always nonsense to think the BBC has any party political bias. I don't think it does. I think the BBC, the challenge for all the broadcasters was about the content of what they did and how meaningful their campaign coverage was. And that, as I say, you come back to, we talked about lots of things which didn't happen. And anyone watching the whole of the output, there was one moment where I bridled slightly when I heard a TV reporter after the election say, we were told this was going to take ages. Well, you know, who was doing the telling, mate? It was you. And the narrative that everybody followed, papers, radio, television, was a similar narrative about the closeness of the polls and the unlikelihood of a majority. And I'm not being wise after the event here, because if you look at 2010, people got 2010 wrong. So in 2010, the overwhelming prediction of the pundits was a Conservative majority government. And if you look at the betting markets on the morning of the 2010 election, the spread on Liberal Democrat seats was something like 81 to 83. They ended up with 57. And the likely Tory majority predicted, or the Tory lead over Labour in 2010, was predicted as being 100 seats, and it turned out to be 50. So we were wrong in 2010, and I just don't think people thought enough about what if we're wrong in 2015.
And I don't think you ever find out much about what somebody thinks by asking them to speculate. I'm not sure that hypotheticals are ever very much used. I mean, if you go to a football manager and say, how will you feel if it's a draw, you're not going to learn much.
No, I suppose that there is a definite public interest in knowing what kind of coalition might emerge. And in that case, there were bits that didn't quite analyse as rigorously as some other much-travelled byways. So Labour and SNP was examined 1,788,000 times. A possible Conservative alliance with the DUP in Ulster was examined not really very much at all, and in some ways was a more likely scenario and could still be something which happens during this Parliament if the Conservative majority shrinks as it actuarially will do. So I think we didn't quite get that right either. And you have to just keep, in an election, doing two things. What is it that matters to the voters? And editorially, what is the range of outcomes that we might have here? And it wasn't, I think, completely ludicrous to imagine that there might be a majority government. I think the Labour majority, in fairness, had gone away once Scotland started happening. But a Tory majority was always a possibility, and it was underexplored.
So what's going to happen now in terms of impartiality and balance in political programmes, in breakfast shows, in discussion programmes? Third biggest party is the SNP. They, by definition, don't have any representation in the majority of the country, but the majority of the country has to abide by the rules of balance. That's going to cause some chin-scratching, I think, isn't it, in political journalism circles?
I think that there's always been an anchor of coverage, and the anchor of coverage is the makeup of the House of Commons. Now, I think you have to be pragmatic about things like the birth of the SDP or the rise of UKIP, and you can't ignore those or underestimate those. But the basis of traditional Radio 4 representation, certainly, and most of that spreading across the radio industry, has been the makeup of the Commons. And in that case, the Liberal Democrats are now a very, very small party. They've got, I think, the same number of roughly seats as the DUP, and they've got a very low popular vote. And I saw on television over the weekend a panel discussion with the traditional papers reviewers who were, you know, one Labourish person, one Toryish person, one Liberal Democrat person. That's going to look old-fashioned because we now have a position in which the Tories and Labour still remain the two big parties, but it is, as you say, the SNP in third place. And even though you can't vote for the SNP in England, they will be a major force in the politics of the whole of the UK, and they will need to be represented certainly by the network programmes. I'm not saying that Radio Northampton needs to go too big on the SNP, but it certainly will change the way that our magazine programmes look at their panels, and the flavour of the whole politics of the country has changed. We've got to recognise that.
Just one other thing that's not specific about the general election. We all on the radio do newspaper reviews. It's just one of those stock things we do to fill up space on our breakfast shows. And I often worry that what we do is characterise the British opinion by the Telegraph, the Mail, the Express, that, you know, there are more right-wing newspapers than there are left-wing ones, if right and left has any meaning anymore. Do we balance our newspaper coverage properly, our newspaper reviews?
Well, there are ways of avoiding an over-concentration on newspapers, and part of that is that social media can these days undercut newspapers. And I occasionally meet a student who will say to me, Rupert Murdoch runs the country. And I say that whatever you think about Rupert Murdoch, and there are, as you know, a million different views, I think he is less powerful than he was in 1992 because there's so much diversity of media now that you can get alternative views. I do think you're right. And I thought Robert Peston from the BBC made a good point a year or two back that the Daily Mail often complains about BBC bias, sometimes with justice, sometimes not. But the Daily Mail is a key determinant of the daily broadcast news agenda. And the Daily Mail is a very, very good newspaper. That's why it drives so much of the agenda. But you're right that there is a, you know, there's no real equivalent range on the left of the press that there is on the right. And that is something you always have to bear in mind with newspaper reviews. So I think you have to filter newspaper reviews possibly more than is done sometimes these days to make sure that people are aware that the real debate may be happening on Twitter rather than in the Independent on Sunday.
So if you and I were setting up a breakfast show now for a local radio station, would we be saying, let's maybe not have a newspaper review, but let's review, I don't know, BuzzFeed and the Huffington Post and Twitter?
Well, I think that the dog that didn't bark during this election was that people said that there was going to be the great counterbalancing organised internet of BuzzFeed and the rest. And it was traditional media that still won the election. And I come back to the fact that I thought a lot of the TV and radio coverage had admirable energy and innovation and life. And the really big drivers of the agenda were the television and radio debates, which consumed huge amounts of talk. And really, there wasn't the organised intervention by the internet that some people had predicted. So I don't think you can go too far down that line. What I do wonder is just whether morning newspaper reviews could be more about the way that broadcast media has been covering stories with some reflection of the newspapers too, because most people these days take their media in all sorts of ways that aren't the traditional sit down and read a paper from beginning to end. So innovative ways of trying to reflect that are good. And certainly, I think people these days, the regular public, are quite jaundiced about the bias they see to left or right in various newspapers. And it's why, ultimately, that radio and television are more trusted, because they are better at being impartial.
Roger, thank you ever so much for your time today. It's great to see you again. That's Roger Mosey, who is now officially Radio Today's political pundit. Did you know that? You've just been appointed. Let's have some news now from Stuart Clarkson.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Thank you, Trevor. Roy Martin on holiday this week, having a great time in the sunshine, and he sends his best wishes to you all. We're trying not to miss him too much here at Radio Today. Let's have a look at the big stories of the week then. There's a new man in ultimate charge of broadcasting in the UK. John Whittingdale named the new Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport this week after the post-election cabinet reshuffle. His views on the BBC especially are well known from his 10 years chairing the Culture Select Committee. But commentators say despite some of the press headlines, it may not actually be the beginning of the end for the corporation just yet. Watch this space. Well, back at his desk at DCMS this week as well is the Minister of State for Culture and the Digital Economy, Ed Vasey. He returns to the same gig he had before the election. Five Live's Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo have done a pilot of a new thing. If you've not seen it, it's very nice, televisual kind of thing, featuring nicely shot bits of their radio show as well as specially filmed links at New Broadcasting House and clips from the films that they're talking about. Check it out on the Radio Today website. It's well worth a look. From movies to moves, and after covering the show for the last month or so, Alex Duffy has been confirmed as the new breakfast jock at Bowers Viking FM in Hull. The radio legend Mike Reed has been booked for a week of cover at BBC Sussex and Surrey later this month. And Kate Thornton, most recently on the Radio 2 schedule, has signed for Magic to do a new Sunday afternoon series of music and interviews with celebs. Congratulations to Mike Toulon and Chelsea Norris at Key 103 in Manchester, celebrating 10 years on Breakfast together this week. And good luck to all nominees in this year's Arqiva Commercial Radio Awards. If you're listening to this podcast after lunchtime Thursday, then head to radiotoday.co.uk to see the full shortlist for each category, and we'll see you at the awards in London in July. That's the latest from Radio Today's newsroom. I'm Stuart Clarkson.
Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis, offer you elegantly integrated products and intelligent one-stop shopping for all your studio needs. Discover a full range of innovative studio products. Play out by Wide Orbit, Music Master Scheduling, Stirlitz, NewsBoss, Larvo, Telos, Axia, Omnia, Digigram and Commotion. Visit bionics.co.uk today.
Radio Moments. The nature of commentary means you never quite know what's going to happen, and sometimes what you're called upon to put into words isn't quite what you anticipated. It's 30 years this week since Tony Delahunty popped up for a routine football commentary shift for IRN and Pennine Radio.
We're on fire here at Valley Parade. The whole end of the stand at one side is actually in flames now. I can see the orange of the flames. The game is actually stopped here at Valley Parade. Before that, there was a certain amount of shaking of fists and a bit of a hoo-ha at that far end. And they're running out of the ground now from that far end at this moment. And I'm hoping that the police, I can see some policemen's helmets over there, can control this. It looks like there could be a situation of panic, but all the time people are spilling onto the pitch and we can see the flames going up into the air there. We're getting reports outside that...
Tony Delahunty, commentating live for IRN and Pennine at Valley Parade this week in 85. 56 people died. At Radio 1, 40 years ago this week, the station's fun day out outside broadcast went to Mallory Park.
Hi there, Radio 1 listeners. We're the Bay City Rollers.
That's a record that the Rollers picked out as their particular favourite. That was the Beatles and All You Need Is Love. We have the most amazing scenes going on here this afternoon, as you can no doubt hear, partly going on behind us since the Rollers have been here. We have a little river surrounding, two various parts of the track here, and the girls are actually swimming across the river to try and get at their idols. In the meantime, their idols are trying to get away, and in the meantime, we're about to meet our next guest from Slade, Noddy Holder.
I was being driven around a lake by a womble, and waving to the crowd. And as the Bay City Rollers were being helicoptered in, all the kids jumped into the lake. And there were security guards trying to stop them getting over onto this island.
Tony Blackburn and Diddy David Hamilton reflecting on that famous Radio 1 event 40 years ago. The early commercial stations were famous for real characters, weren't they? Happy birthday then this week to the chap who turned into part of Jasper Carrot's act.
So obviously, this is a big day for BRNB and for Tony Butler. And he sent his top reporter up there called Ari Truthui. So they go to a commercial break, he comes off and Butler says, what a fantastic day for the Albion. They've thrashed Oldham 1-0 and shot into the first division. And man on the spot, Harry Tathui, is talking to the Albion goalkeeper, John Osborne. Coming, Harry. Harry? Harry? And Harry came and said, Town, he's pissed off.
Yes, this week sees the 80th birthday for accomplished BRNB and BBC WM sports broadcaster Tony Butler.
Right, well, my champagne quiz question's very difficult this week. I'm giving you no clues at all. I'm fed up of giving the bottles away. You've got to sweat a little bit, let me say. Although, really, I do think that everybody who took part in the walkathon yesterday would have a bottle of champagne.
Gardening has a regular spot on many BBC locals, and it all began 84 years ago.
This is the national programme, In Your Garden. And here's Mr. Middleton.
Good evening. Well, how do you like this for a bit of spring weather? Perhaps I shall get rid of my winter cold if we get a month or two of this. It's wonderful what a difference a day or two can make, isn't it, in the garden. I had a look at Wisley last night, or yesterday evening, Wisley Gardens, and it looks just as though...
I love the posh continuity. The first gardening programme on the 9th of May 1931, it was called The Week in the Garden, and a very early example of ad-libbing, very informal presentation. In America, stations frequently flip formats, and so it was that this week in 82, the famous Music Radio 77 WABC, became no more. It went talk.
There is one thing that I want to say that will be probably the last time that, as a matter of fact, it will be the last time I will ever be able to say this on WABC. And the last thing I'm going to say is, this is WABC New York. I can't say that anymore, can I? But it's been a ball for almost 21 years for me, 17 years for you, Ryan, for almost 22 years of the programming that's been on the station all this time. And we'd like to play just a couple of things to nail it down. Let's have that.
WABC. May the 10th, 1982, and the end of a 22-year era for that New York station. 5 years ago now, and who's this walking out of a Radio 4 programme?
And finally, you can either answer this or not. I'll just give you the chance because it's out there at the moment. As you know, that... the suggestion you didn't want to say the famous line in Gladiator in this book that has come out...
Thank you.
I don't get the Irish thing, bro. I don't get it at all.
Russell Crowe walking out of BBC Radio 4's Front Row interview with Mark Lawson this week in 2010. Staying with Radio 4, this week in 1991 saw Margaret Howard present her last edition of Pick of the Week.
Of course, I didn't work at Bush House all the time. During my apprenticeship as a studio manager, I worked at Broadcasting House, where they broadcast in English domestically. And I made my first real broadcast there. I was doing the sound effects on a programme called Listen with Mother. And it was a story about three pigs going over a bridge on bicycles. And one of my jobs was to ring a bicycle bell on cue each time the little pig went, the middle pig and the big pig.
Yes, ring them bells, Margaret Howard. So with the R&I pirate radio ship firebombed 44 years ago.
Mayday, mayday, SOS, this is an SOS call from Radio North Sea International.
To LO, launching 92 years ago, the second UK station to broadcast regularly.
To LO, call.
Primetime radio, closing on DAB 9 years ago. And happy 65th birthday to Jenny Murray.
How has the programme handled men?
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments.
Thank you, David. Thank you also to Roger Mosey and to Stuart Clarkson for the news this week. That's been your Radio Today programme. Next time, we'll be visiting IPE, a company I'd never heard of until a couple of weeks ago. But they're the people who make radio studios. They made all the BBC radio studios for New Broadcasting House. So it'll be very interesting to hear what they've got to say about modern radio studio design. Join me for that if you can next week. This has been a TDC production for Radio Today. I've been Trevor Dan. Thanks for listening.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.